One of the big movies out right now is The Odyssey by Christopher Nolan. I'm not going to spoil the movie for you, but I actually want to talk about the poem or the book on which it was based. Now, the poem is about 3,000 years old, so I'm going to try and avoid major spoilers, but if you haven't read it by now, you might not get a chance to. But The Odyssey is the story of a man named Odysseus. Odysseus has been off to war for nearly 10 years fighting against the Trojans, and he is on his way back home. And The Odyssey is the story of his long and difficult journey to get back home. And there are many reasons that cause the difficulty of the journey, but one of them happens early on in the journey back home. He lands on an island along with some of his men, and they find a cave, and the cave is the home of Polyphemus, this Cyclops. And there's a lot of conversation back and forth. I'm not going to tell you the whole story. And in the midst of that, Odysseus tricks Polyphemus, and he tells him his name is No One or No Man. And then in order to escape from the Cyclops, Odysseus attacks the Cyclops, and they run away. And the Cyclops is crying out in pain, and the other Cyclops are asking, well, who's hurting you? And he says, well, no man is hurting me. And they're like, well, if no one's man is hurting you, then what's the problem? And then Odysseus gets to his ship. And at this moment, Odysseus could simply sail off and everything would be okay. But Odysseus has a moment of pride. He wants the Cyclops to know who has conquered him. So he calls out and he says, know this, I am Odysseus, sacker of cities, son of... And he goes on and tells the Cyclops who he is. Well, this was a bad choice. Why? Because the Cyclops is the son of Poseidon, the god of the sea. And so the Cyclops now cries out in agony, having been seriously wounded by Odysseus, and says, oh, Poseidon, I want a curse on Odysseus. Well, Odysseus' trip home is extremely cursed. The wrath of Poseidon rains down on him. Odysseus, at this point in time, has ships with 12 ships worth of men with him. By the time Odysseus gets back home, it's Odysseus by himself. And there are numerous things in it. It's not all due to this trip with the Cyclops, but that's a major point of it. There's this moment where, in Odysseus' pride, he chooses to do something, and then the wrath of the gods fall on him. And it causes a ripple effect of all these problems and issues for Odysseus. Now, we may not ever go into the cave of a Cyclops. Probably not, right? But most of us, I think, may think back on moments in time where we had a choice, where we had an option, and we chose a bad option. We did the wrong thing. And sometimes our wrong choices, maybe it was a lie we told, something we took, maybe something we said to someone, has a ripple effect. And it goes down through history. And sometimes maybe we feel like the wrath of God is following us along, that because of these choices, we're just being punished time and time again by God. The story we're going to look at today is about a couple of people who make a choice. And their choice has severe consequences. And it rolls down. But the story as it goes on is very different than the story of Odysseus. We'll see some changes, and we'll also see in particular the way that the God of the Bible responds to these mistakes versus the way that Poseidon and the other gods of the Odyssey respond to Odysseus. And so we heard part of the story today in Genesis chapter 3. And so I want to set up a little bit of what happens before that. We'll go through it quickly, and the early chapters of Genesis have lots of interesting stories, lots of things, lots of questions. We're not going to get to every single one of those questions. Some of them I'm going to simply pass on by because we just don't have the kind of time for that. Now, but basically those first two chapters of Genesis, we hear about God creating the world and all that's in it. And at the conclusion of that creation, he places in this garden space that he has created where he's brought order, he places a man and a woman. And this first man and woman, they're created to be partners together, to stand side by side, to be by their side, and to be for each other, to be strong partners or strong allies for one another. Now, we refer to them as Adam and Eve. The names come a little bit later in the story, but I'll simply use the names Adam and Eve for these two. And they're in this garden, and they're given one command. I mean, they're given several commands. Most of them are to be fruitful, to multiply, to serve and protect the garden. But they're also given one thing they can't do. Because in the center of the garden is the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. We're not sure exactly what all the implications of that are. But there's this tree that they're told not to eat from. And as the story begins, it seems as if everything is going great. Chapter 2 ends with Adam and his wife were both naked and they felt no shame. There's a sense where they're living in harmony together. They're living in unity together. Everything's going great until we start chapter 3. Now, we don't know how much time actually takes place between where the story ends in chapter 2 and where it begins in chapter 3. For us, it's a period. But it could have been a long time. It could have been a short time. But chapter 3 begins now talking about a serpent who's more crafty than all the wild animals. And this serpent comes and approaches Eve and begins to question God's command. Well, did God really say you couldn't eat from that? And there's this conversation back and forth about this tree. Remember the tree they're not supposed to eat from? And the serpent says, well, you can eat from that. God's been lying to you about what's going to happen. And then it says this in verse 6. It says, when the woman saw the fruit of the tree, and she said, she took some and ate it. And then it continues, she also gave some to her husband, and he ate it. So some important details there. The man was standing there. This wasn't later on. So she takes some, she eats it, and then she gives it to the man. Now we might have questions again. There's all those questions. Why does the serpent talk to Eve and not to Adam? Why doesn't Adam say anything? The text doesn't tell us. And so anything beyond that is speculation. But there's this moment when they choose to eat from this fruit is often referred to as the fall. But I like N.J. Gupta, a New Testament scholar and biblical scholar, says he likes to refer to it as the unraveling or the undoing. And I kind of like that because it's like everything just falls apart from here. It says after eating, they realize their nakedness. In other words, there's been a change in the way how they see each other. They begin to hide and they sew fig leaves and they realize like our relationship, this unity, this harmony they've been experiencing has been broken. Then we pick up the story. The man and his wife heard the sound of the Lord God walking in the garden, which was apparently something God did often. God's just walking in the garden. And what do the man and the woman, what do Adam and Eve do? They hide. They hide from God. Well, why are they hiding from God? What do children do when they do something wrong and they hear mom or dad come in the door? Often they hide, right? That's the typical response. And the Lord God called to the man, where are you? Now, I don't think God doesn't know this. I think God's fully aware of it, but it's this opportunity given to the man. And the man answers, well, I heard you and I was afraid because I was naked, so I hid. God's like, well, who told you you were naked? Which is an interesting thing. Well, like, could they not see they were naked? I don't know. But in other words, who told you, who caused you to be in this place where you were aware of something changing this? Have you eaten from the tree that I commanded you not to eat from? Again, I don't think God is confused or unaware of what has happened. And going back to our parent and child, it's one of those things where you walk in, the parent walks in, the child has like chocolate all over their face and some crumbs and walks over. It's like, who ate the cookies? Well, the parent is fully well aware of who ate the cookies. One, because nobody else has been home. Two, because there's evidence all over the child's face. But here, God, the evidence is all over Adam and Eve. The fact that they're hiding, the fact that they've got figs on and they've clothed themselves, the fact that they say they're naked, the fact that they're hiding from God. All this points to the fact of what they've done, but God is giving him, in some sense, an opportunity. And I'll put it this way. The man doesn't do a very good job with his opportunity. The man said, what happened? That woman you put here, the strong partner you made for me, the strong partner, you made this woman here, you gave her to me. That's why I did it. She gave it to me and I ate it. So notice Adam, what did you do? Well, it's her fault. Well, it's your fault. You gave her to me. So he's blaming Eve. He's blaming God. He's kind of pointing all around everywhere but at himself. There's no remorse. No, well, I really shouldn't have done that. And interestingly, we don't ever hear from Adam again. These are his last words. Not literally, but last words were told in the Bible. Adam's out of the story. But then it comes to the woman. He says to her, well, what have you done? What is this you have done? And what I think we notice here is one is they're both responsible for their own choices. He's looking at Adam. He says, well, what have you done? He's looking at Eve. What have you done? He knows they've both eaten. He's not holding Adam responsible for Eve, nor is he holding Eve responsible for Adam. He's asking both of them, what have you done? What was the choice you made? Now, Eve's answer also isn't optimal. It's maybe a little bit better. Well, the serpent deceived me, which you might suggest, well, where'd the serpent come from? But doesn't matter. The serpent deceived me and I ate. In other words, I did it. I mean, she takes at least a little bit of responsibility, though maybe just a little more. What I want to be clear, though, is Eve is not a Bible hero, nor is Adam in this case. But they've chosen for themselves, and they've decided for themselves right and wrong. They've chosen to believe someone. They've chosen to believe the serpent over God as the source of truth. And from this point comes the unraveling or the undoing, and God spells those out in the following verses about what happens. And sometimes it's called the curse, but as we look at it a little bit, the serpent is cursed, the ground is cursed, but the man and the woman themselves are not cursed. There's consequences. And it talks about in verse 14, the serpent is cursed and he crawls on the ground, but it says, key verse 15, and I will put enmity between you and the woman and between your offspring and hers. He will crush your head and you will strike his heel. In other words, there's going to be this ongoing struggle between the seed, the offspring of the woman, and the serpent. And I don't think it's so much as we read through the rest of the Bible, I don't think it's so much about us and snakes. Now, I know most people don't really care for snakes a whole lot, but this isn't so much about that. It's about this ongoing struggle between the people of God and anything that opposes God and his kingdom. And so he's setting up, there's going to be this struggle, but there won't always be the struggle. At some point, the serpent, the forces of evil and death will be defeated, but we'll get there. He said, then the words to the woman, there are consequences. Consequences, in some sense, in light of what's just happened, there's a change in what happens. And part of it is, the language here is, I will make your pains in childbearing, or I will make your toil in childbearing very severe, with painful labor, with in pain or in toil, you will conceive and give birth to children. I think what it's getting at is more than just the physical pain of childbirth. One scholar talks about it as saying, this is the agony, the hardship, the worry, the anxiety of the circumstances in which children are born, conceived, and raised, in which they die. Part of that is because the same sort of language is used for the man, through painful toil you will eat food from it all the days of your life. In other words, he says to the man, planting and gardening and stuff is going to be a struggle and a challenge. To the woman, having children is going and raising them is going to be a struggle and going to be a challenge. And boy, does that turn out to be true even as we start the opening pages of Genesis. And it continues on. And so what it is, it's not an explanation of why snakes crawl or why people hate snakes or why childbirth is painful. I think it's a deeper picture about God and his response to people who choose their own way and the consequences of it. So again, big picture, man and woman in the garden, it's harmony and unity, but they choose not to trust God and things spiral downhill. At this point, if you or I were God, we might just say, let's just start this whole thing over, right? I gave you one simple command. You had everything you could eat from any tree in the garden. I told you just not, don't touch that one. Don't eat from that one. And they did. But that's not how God responds. And so here is Eve at this moment of failure. And it's a big one. It's a big one, and it has consequences for all of humanity and all of creation. But God doesn't toss her aside. Go back to that verse. He says to her, I will put enmity between you and the woman. This is talking to the serpents. In other words, God tells her, or at least she overhears this truth, that through her offspring, there's going to be a solution to this whole problem. Through the offspring of this woman, there's going to be a solution. Now, childbearing and child raising will be fraught with pain and difficulties, and Eve is going to experience these. But God is saying, through this childbearing, as difficult as it will be, will come the restoration of all things. Now, many through church history have seen in Genesis 3:15 words pointing to Jesus. Now, the New Testament never directly connects those, but I think there's a good sense in where we see the stories, we read the storyline and saying, this eventually comes to the point and the reminder that through the offspring of a woman, in this case, the offspring of Mary, the woman, Jesus comes, and it's the defeat of the serpent or the defeat of the forces of death and evil. So notice what's happened to Eve here. She has chosen her way over God's way. She's chosen not to trust God, or the short word we use for it, she has sinned against God. But that sin hasn't erased the possibility of her participating in God's work. God doesn't just write her off and say, well, you made the mistake. No, in fact, he uses her and continues to use her. God doesn't abandon her. And we see how Eve responds, and I want to look at a couple other scenes that follow this and see what are we learning about who Eve is and how she responds, but more importantly, what do we learn about who God is? Because we start to see this, how God responds. Remember this story I started with where how Poseidon just wipes Odysseus and nearly all of Odysseus' men and makes the difficulty for Odysseus extremely challenging. And so here, though, we see a very different response from God. So after this whole scene, and there's the words to the man in the start of chapter 4, by the start of chapter 4, God has taken the man and the woman, and he's placed them out of the garden, and he's put a cherubim and a flaming sword to keep them from entering back into this garden. They've gone out into the world. And one of the things that happens shortly after that, again, don't know how much time takes place. It's a period from the end of chapter 3 to the start of chapter 4. But we have Eve giving birth to a child, which was one of the commands they were given, to be fruitful and multiply. And she says this in response. This is the birth of her son, Cain. With the help of the Lord, I have brought forth a man. She's looking with the help of the Lord. She refers to God, the Lord, as Yahweh, the personal name, the first person in the Bible to do that. She gives thanks or praise to God. She's in exile. She's come out of, but she's still recognizing that even though she is exiled from the garden, God is still providing for her. With the help of the Lord, I have done this. Adam was there too, but with the help of the Lord, I have done this. I have brought forth a child. And Eve, maybe in the back of her mind, is hoping this will be that seed. Remember, she was promised, oh, one of your offspring is going to defeat the serpent. Well, she has another son named Abel. And the story goes on, and Cain kills Abel, and then Cain gets banished. So the hopes of those two being the promised seed to crush the serpent don't go so well. And remember that line to Eve about in difficulty and anxiety and challenge and toil will be childbearing? Her first two children, one kills the other, and he ends up in exile. So child raising, childbearing are difficult and anxious. There's this anguish, the anxiety. But that's not the last thing we're told about Eve. We go on and continue through chapter 4. And we read in chapter 4, verse 21, that she gives birth to another son and names him Seth, saying, God has granted me another child in place of Abel since Cain killed him. And so here again, we see this going on where God, Eve is recognizing, God's, there's still this possibility. In fact, there's some fun Hebrew wordplay, but where it says where God has granted me, it's kind of the same Hebrew word as like where it says where God put enmity between the woman and the man. And there's a play with the word of Seth's name kind of is a pun or a rhyme on that. And then the word child here, granted, God has granted me another child. The word she uses is actually the same word as the word seed that's used back in Genesis 3. And so here she is. She's still clinging to hope. She's saying, God has granted me. God has given to me another child. Maybe this child is the seed. So Eve is hanging on to that promise. She's saying, God has said something is going to happen and evil will be defeated and a seed will come. We see a little glimpse because the verse continues. At that time, people began to call on the name of the Lord. They're beginning to worship. They're beginning to look to God for salvation. And so there's this start of this sense, Eve is hanging on to this hope. And then chapter 5 comes, and chapter 5 is one of the more exciting ones in the beginning of Genesis. It's a genealogy. And we all like genealogies, right? We're told, you know, this person had this many sons, and it goes on and on. We say, well, what's the significance of that? It traces Seth's line to a man named Noah. But I want to go to another place in the Bible which has a genealogy. Chapter 3 of the Gospel of Luke. We're not going to read the whole thing. But Luke chapter 3, verse 23. It talks about Jesus, and it says, Jesus was the son, so it was thought of Joseph. And then goes on, Joseph, the son of Heli, the son of Mattath, the son of Levi, the son of Melchi. All right, fast forward, down to verse 37, the son of Methuselah, the son of Enoch, the son of Jared, the son of Mahalalel, the son of Kenan, the son of Enosh, the son of Seth, the son of Adam, the son of God. You see, so Eve, though she did not know it, when she looks at Seth, she says, maybe this is the one. He's not the one. But a long time later, through his descendants, through those seed, through those offspring, comes Jesus. The one who will crush the serpent. The one who does crush the serpent and the forces of death and the forces of evil. Eve didn't live to see it. But she clung to that promise. That through her offspring, God would defeat evil, which he does in Jesus. And so when we start to think about this story in particular of Eve, what do we see? What does it tell us about who God is? And what does it tell us about the life of faith? First of all, I don't want to erase in any way the sin of Eve. She chose wrongly. She chose to sin against God. She chose to disobey. But I think there are things we might learn from her, either by a positive or by a negative example. One is, I think part of as we think about who Eve was and what she did, it's a call for us to cultivate a wisdom grounded in what God says is good. We need to be the kind of people and learn the kind of wisdom that recognizes when God says something is good, to know that and to believe it. Even when we're told, not necessarily by a talking serpent, but we hear messages in some way that contradict and say, well, did God really say that? Is that really what God wants? Or what the serpent suggests to God about God, God's holding out on you. God's keeping you from something. Because sometimes we hear or we read what God calls us to do, the kind of people he calls us to be, and we think, well, God's holding out on me. God's keeping something from me. Or maybe we start to think, I know that's what God says, but I've got a better idea. And so as we consider the story of Eve, we might want to think about how can we cultivate the kind of wisdom, the kind of choices to say, no, God knows best. And the call, the challenge is to follow him. The second thing I think we see in the story of Eve is the call to trust in God's promises. we see that in Eve where she clings to it. She has this relentless hope, a hope in redemption. God says to her, the serpent will be crushed through your seed. She has a son. She thinks, well, maybe it's him. That son kills her, his brother. No, that's not the one. Then she has another son, and it's not him. And he has a son, and it's not him. And then there's child after child after child after child down through the generations until one is born who will do it. Which reminds us, sometimes the promises that God gives us or that redemption is not something we will see in our life. But it will come. God has promised the defeat of evil, and it came in Jesus, and he promises that one day he will return and make all things right. It may come in our lifetime, it may come 100 lifetimes from now, but it will come. And so the invitation is to see in Eve this relentless hope. And then I think we also turn, and more importantly, as within our Bible stories, we look and we say, this isn't a story necessarily, none of the stories in our Bible are necessarily to tell us about the people or following the people. Stories are to tell us what God is like. And in this story, we see a God of grace. Now, we think of the Old Testament, oftentimes in church, we're taught, well, the Old Testament, God's the mean, cruel God, and then we come along to Jesus, the God of grace. It starts in the beginning here where God clothes the man and the woman. He puts them out of the garden, but then he continues to bless them and to have children. And he does not define Eve by the mistakes she made. He offers her a second chance. In fact, here is this woman, one of the first two human beings who has chosen to go against him. And he says, through you, I'm going to use you to save all of creation. God can use even people who've rebelled to be a part of his plan. And so it is a reminder of how God works and how God's grace works, that as we think about ourselves, we say, well, I did this thing, or this is what happened to me, and I'm not sure. We say, now here's a reminder, God uses people in spite of their sin. Sometimes through what's gone on, he does amazing things through it. We are not defined by the mistakes or the sins that we do. That's not how God sees us. God sees us as children who are dearly loved, who he wants to change and to redeem. Now, does he want us to make the mistakes and sins? No. He wants us to change, but he does not define us in those ways, just as he doesn't define Eve. The other thing, now looking back from our perspective, is we can celebrate that promise that, to use a bit of a pun, the seed of a promise that happens in Genesis 3 there. Because we know the innocent, Adam and Eve, and even the readers in the Old Testament, Moses, when he wrote these words, didn't know what he was talking about. He didn't know who this seed would be or what it would look like. But now we look back and we say, that seed, that descendant of Seth, was Jesus. And in Jesus, and through his death on the cross, through his resurrection, through his ascension, sin, death, and the devil have been defeated. And one day when Jesus returns, the final enemy, death, will be cast into the lake of fire, and all will be done, and the serpent will be crushed forever and ever. And so we read in this story a chance to celebrate, because we see from a different way that God will not allow sin and death to have the final word. He told it to Eve, and he tells it to us, that sin and death do not have the final say. But God, through Jesus, has defeated those. And so as we look back on this story, as we see Eve and her relentless hope, as we see how God responds to Eve and says, your sins do not define you, and I will use you, and I will bring the defeat of evil. It's what we celebrate today. And when we come to the communion table and take the bread and the cup, we're reminding ourselves of a promise that God made way back at the beginning, a promise fulfilled in Jesus. And as we take the bread and the cup, and Jesus says, and I will be with you till I come again, we hear those words, a promise that we can trust in. So in these stories, may we hear hope. May we hear promise. May we hear about a God who is always and evermore a God of grace. Amen.